Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Andrew Lukashinis. I represent the appellant and claimant below, Dwight Abrams. As our briefing is laid out, we essentially draw the Court's attention to three issues from the proceedings below, two of which grounded in due process violations that we allege, and one under the substantial evidence standard. I'd like to focus on one of those due process issues, namely the usage of the AMA guides in Chrysler's counsel's closing argument, as they were read into the record during summation and then criticized, or rather characterized, claimant's expert as not complying with those guides during his evaluation that was presented to the board. Essentially, in terms of basic factual overview, this is rather straightforward. There was evidence that was put before the board at the hearing. I believe in our appendix at page A105, you'll note the last, the hearing closed, the evidentiary record closed. Both parties rested, and the board offered attorneys opportunities to make summations based on the evidence that was within the record. At that point, the parties had submitted evidence, two medical experts had testified, and this is where claimant's counsel offered a closing argument, and then during Chrysler's counsel's closing argument, the AMA guides were read from. Specific portions were read into the record that had previously not been introduced to the record, and claimant's counsel then drew conclusions that Dr. Bandera, who was claimant's expert, had misapplied these guides.
Let me ask you a couple of questions that I confess the catalyst for them is the fact I never practiced before the Industrial Accident Board, so bear with me. Are treatises such as the AMA guide generally accepted as reference books for the IAB decisions?
That is an excellent question. I will tell you that I do not believe that there is clear authority to allow for that. There are some states that do have a policy, or their courts have found that they are acceptable to reference those materials. Delaware does not have a statutory provision, and we do not have any case law that speaks specifically to that point.
Well, if a witness, as your medical expert deposition suggests, relied on a particular treatise or reference book for his opinion, what is in place to bar the board from looking at it to see if he read it correctly or not?
In terms of having the board become an independent investigator, I would suggest that's empowering the board a bit too much of an investigative function if they're going to be taking it upon themselves to delve into these medical treatises.
Okay, well, let's assume that there is a reference in the course of argument to the code or to a set of regulations promulgated pursuant to a statute. Administrative agencies are allowed to look at those to see whether or not they have been interpreted correctly, are they not?
I would submit to you that a medical treatise is significantly different than the Delaware Code, for example, or administrative regulation. These types of materials typically have some expert qualification to them. They are interpreted and utilized by people in positions to understand them and utilize them correctly. And I understand that the board does have a certain amount of expertise in the workers' compensation area. However, if we turn to the Turbitt versus Blueham case, the court admonished the board that while they do have expertise in this area, that their expertise is for evaluating the evidence before them. And they can't create their own evidence.
Well, but the evidence before them included the treatise because your medical expert spoke to it.
I would grant you that it included a reference to that treatise. I would simply suggest that in terms of keeping with the fundamental fairness requirements of due process, that the appropriate method would have been for, if there are concerns about the application of those provisions of the treatise, would have been for a cross-examination or an opposing witness.
Well, I'm putting aside for a moment what opposing counsel did or didn't do.
Okay.
Let's assume there was nothing said by opposing counsel. Would it have been inappropriate or a violation of due process for the board to say, something along the lines of, we've looked at Dr. Banderas' testimony, we've looked at the assumptions he made and the authorities on which he relied, and we believe there's a distinction between column A for an illness-produced difficulty with the low back and or whatever part of the body, and a traumatic injury to the back. And he's got the wrong column, mm-hmm. because it's plain English. This is the methodology used when it's illness. This is the methodology used when it's injury, direct injury. Why is that different than any other industry protocol or accepted frame of reference within a particular business sector?
I understand Your Honor's question, and I would suggest that although the board is certainly free to determine the credibility of Dr. Bandera, for example, and to evaluate his testimony based on their credibility determination, that if they're going to be delving further in to this treatise, for example, and doing an independent investigation, that's more along the lines of a juror with an internet connection. They're a fact finder, and they're doing an investigation.
Is there anything in the record that would uphold the board's determination that the opposing side's doctor is more credible, apart from the reference to the AMA guidelines?
That is certainly within the board's discretion to determine between two experts, and we do not submit that they have to agree with our expert. Our position is simply that the references were inappropriate and that...
Okay, well, what I'm asking is, let's assume that you're correct.
Mm-hmm.
Still, is that error harmless because there's other evidence in the record which would allow the board to accept the other side's expert over your expert?
I would suggest that it is not harmless error, namely because key in the board's decision was that they did note that they believed that Dr. Bandera had misapplied the guides. The only suggestion, there was no suggestion that he had misapplied those guides at the close of the evidentiary record. At A105, the record closed. There had not been any suggestion that his ability to apply these guides hadn't been impugned by any expert or any other cross-examination. So I would suggest to Your Honor that it's a prejudicial error because it comes right into their opinion, and the only suggestion was based upon these comments that were after the record had closed. So I would suggest that it is a prejudicial error and it's far from harmless.
Let me move quickly to my second question that originates for the same reason as the first.
Mm-hmm.
We're accustomed to juries being instructed that attorneys' closing argument or summations is not evidence, and there it's to be disregarded to the extent it purports to be evidence. Is the IAB operating under the same formula, understanding that what an attorney says is simply argument and it doesn't constitute evidence on which they could rely?
Theoretically I would suggest that it should operate under that function. I would offer that there are not cautionary instructions that are given in this context, and so it does become a little hazier, not unlike the unified fact finder adjudicatory body, like in the cases that the court drew our attention to.
Well, I understand there are no instructions given to them. They're not going to instruct themselves.
Of course not.
I get that. But do they have protocols themselves? Do they have a standard operating procedure? And in it, does it say anything about we understand or we are to understand that what attorneys say to us is simply argument and not evidence?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. There is the IAB rules specifically with respect to summations and closings are quite brief. It just instructs that the parties have an opportunity to offer a summation of their argument. If they have an internal policy as to how that's to be understood, I do not know the answer to that.
Well, there was an objection to the comments made by opposing counsel.
Yes.
So the board was aware of the distinction between argument and evidence, correct?
That is, yes.
Okay.
But to continue with the cases that our attention was drawn to by the court, in the Barks case, we have this cautionary instruction that the trial judge acting as a fact finder should use caution in taking judicial notice, taking notice of materials outside the record, because that impinges upon a fundamental fairness, a notice requirement.
You keep saying outside the record. If, If the AMA guides referred to by your expert, are you suggesting that he can't even testify about it unless it's introduced into evidence? The tome itself?
I'm sorry.
The tome itself has to be introduced into evidence? I thought our rules of evidence said you didn't introduce items like that.
And I would concur absolutely. When I say outside the record, what I intend to mean is that there was new content, as in the doctor testifies to X, Y, and Z, but A, B, and C were introduced in this summation. Okay, so there was additional content that was not previously discussed or referenced during any direct or cross examination. So when I
take your point.
Okay,
so let's assume that the Industrial Accident Board, which does thousands of these cases, and they're very familiar with the AMA guidelines. They're often cited, and they believe, based upon testimony they're hearing, that the doctor has committed not just a mistake, but plain error in misapplying the guidelines. They cannot reject the doctor's testimony under that circumstance without somebody asking a question, including possibly a board member?
Well, as I understand it, there is a statutory mechanism where the board could appoint its own expert. If they were so convinced and there was not any additional testimony that they could utilize to point to discredit a medical opinion, there is a statutory mechanism where the board could say, we need our own expert in this situation. It is clear to us that we can't get a handle on this based upon the information before us. So the statute provides for a mechanism in order to have the board assisted by an independent expert. And I would suggest that in a situation like this, given your hypothetical, that perhaps that would be the more appropriate route to take, as opposed to the board going back to its study and reading up.
Would the outcome be different if the board members started asking questions directly of the witness?
The outcome of this particular case?
Right. Let's assume that all of the argument of the employer's counsel was essentially predicted mm-hmm. by a board member who just started examining the witness and asking questions.
As I understand the board's rules, they are permitted to ask questions on their own motion. To the extent that they could ask questions and they would resolve some of these issues, that I don't know that I can foresee the outcome there, but clearly the board has some authority to question witnesses.
Well, as I understand your argument, it's that if there's a reference to a treatise, whatever the witness discusses is in the record. If you want to cross-examine based on another part of the treatise, it's in the record. And if the board wants to ask questions based on part of the treatise, it's in the record. But the fact that a treatise has been referred to generally doesn't open it up to someone in closing argument to say something on a page that was never testified, asked about, or had any cross-examination.
Correct. And our position is that offends the notice requirement of due process in these administrative hearings, that there's not a meaningful opportunity at that point to controvert evidence that comes in during closing, to rebut it or in any way to deal with it.
Well, no evidence comes in during closing.
I apologize for new information. The submission by counsel to the board.
Really what you're talking about is an argument based upon evidence that's not in the record.
Exactly.
Okay. I just want to make sure I understand.
No, that's exactly correct.
So if the question had been asked by the board, counsel, any objection if we take judicial notice of the AMA guidelines? Would that have been sufficient?
Again, with respect to taking judicial notice, I would refer back to the the Barks case and the Quaker Hill case that we want to use some caution when taking judicial notice. If there had been ample opportunity for the parties to be informed and to, again, respond to that information, I would think that would somewhat deal with the issue. But that's not what we have before us here with respect to the AMA guidelines.
But as a matter of law, may the board take judicial notice of the AMA guidelines or not?
I would suggest that they should. I would suggest they cannot do so, and I would suggest that it's dangerous in that situation to have them take judicial notice of technical material to that effect.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
I did, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Christine O'Connor. I'm here representing Chrysler Group today in this matter. This case involved a simple issue when you really look at things. Did Mr. Abrams suffer permanent impairment to these multiple body parts as a result of his compensable lung injury? The board has specialized knowledge, as this court knows, to handle permanency issues. This is what they deal with every day. The guides, although I don't know if it's written down specifically.
Can they then dispense with expert testimony based on their special expertise?
The case law suggests that they can, although there has to be a basis in the evidence upon which they can do that. In this case, we had two experts testify. I know the argument is about my, dare I say, zealous advocacy at the close of the day. We had Dr. Bandera reference the guides specifically for these body parts, and he talked about the method by which he assigned ratings for loss of function. If you really examine my cross-examination, perhaps it was not the most artful line of questioning, but for each body part, I questioned him about why he was doing what he was doing, why he used the guides as he was using them. For instance, the neck and the back ratings, I clearly suggested, you know, is this an injury case, in your opinion, or is it an illness case? And first he said it was an injury case, and then he admitted we are dealing with an occupational illness. Now the board, because of its knowledge in this area, knows, without me saying so, that when you rate permanency to the neck and back and use the DRE category as Dr. Bandera did, you have to have an injury case. We didn't have that, and Dr. Bandera conceded that during his cross-examination. We have an illness case. So right then and there, the board already knows, without me saying in closing arguments, we have a misstep. The abdomen, the abdominal hernia. No one had causally related the presence of that hernia to the work injury except Dr. Bandera. And the board heard testimony from the claimant on this issue and found at the end of the day even the claimant was not credible.
I want to ask what you're suggesting here at the extent of the board's knowledge. Are you suggesting that without your argument, citing other portions of the AMA guidelines, that the board would have come independently to that conclusion?
I wouldn't use the word independently. The answer is sort of yes, but what they did, if you look at the decision, is they, for each and every aspect of the permanency issues, they pointed to Dr. Myers' testimony and evidence from Dr. Myers, Chrysler's expert, as to why.
Tell me where you're heading with your comments so I can follow them. Are you contending that what you said is proper and we should endorse it and permit it in the future, or are you saying in this case it was harmless?
Both. What I did was I made what I think are strong arguments. That's my job. I didn't offer testimony. I didn't offer an expert opinion. I analyzed what Dr. Bandera said, and I think it's unfair to have him point to a certain aspect of the guides and not direct the board. You know, this is a learning process for the board.
But what your opponent says what's unfair is not asking him about it while he's on the witness stand and simply going to the guide letter later and doing it in the argument, and the cases seem to suggest if there's a concern about the guide, it's what you should do during cross-examination, not in closing.
Sure. And in part, I think I did do that during questioning. You may disagree, but I tried to get at the essence of how he worked through the process. The guides outline a process by which the board determines impairment. The board is the ultimate fact finder and decider of the issue. My comments in closing argument were to ask the board to look at the bigger picture. If Dr. Bandera said I used table X, I just said to the board, but that table is not used for what he's saying it's used for. And that's all I wanted to put everything in context. You can't admit a portion of something and not see the whole.
Who said that other than you?
I'm sorry?
Who said that table is not used for that other than you in closing?
No one said it. It's in the book. our jurisdiction uses the guides. Everybody uses the guides in these cases. It wasn't something that I had just to myself or that the board couldn't look at.
Even I knew that.
I know. I'm truly struggling to defend myself here.
No, and we're not trying to, we're just trying to sort out
right.
how it should operate. There seems to be a suggestion from the cases, including the ones we brought to your attention yesterday.
Sure.
That if you're going to use the guide, you use it during direct and cross-examination. That the guide doesn't come in as a whole, as a treatise, but what you do is use the guide to the extent you have it for direct and cross. And this case is different because I think we can all agree, at least based on the record as we read it, we have things in closing that didn't come out on direct or cross. And the question is that proper? And if it's not, was it harmless?
Well, it's hard for me to say if it's proper. I thought it was proper at the time. I was there to do a job, and to allow an expert just to say, this is how I did it, and this is, you know, the correct way, when it's clearly not. The board could open that book, turn to that page, and see.
Well, nobody's suggesting you can't raise before the board and in the presence of opposing counsel when they have an opportunity to readdress their expert mm-hmm. or to meet your concerns that he used the wrong table or used the wrong framework for analysis. The question is, when do you raise the issue? And I understand you asked questions that made it clear to the board that he believed these were illness-related injuries. Mm-hmm. And then he said, well, maybe they're injury-related. No, they're illness-related. And there is a column or a table for addressing if it's illness and a different one if it's injury. Mm-hmm. I think everybody understands that. But your expert never spoke to which table should be used because he basically concluded none of the injuries were related to the workplace at all.
That's correct.
And then in cross-examination, you didn't put the other side on notice that you believe there was an issue about the erroneous analysis taken from the wrong table and raise it for the first time in closing. That's the due process argument, at least as I understand it, is no notice of the argument in time for the other side to have a fair opportunity to respond. And that because of the way in which the IAB opinion was written, they didn't wholly rely on that argument, but they do mention that that's one of the reasons why they found Dr. Banderas not credible and found Dr. Myers more credible.
I don't think, though, respectfully, that the board said because counsel's arguments were so persuasive,
I'm not saying that at all. That's not at all what I said. In their opinion, they addressed among the reasons why they discounted Dr. Banderas' testimony
correct.
And favored Dr. Myers' testimony was his misapplication mm-hmm. of the guide. And when should that have come before them is the issue. Should there have been a fair opportunity for the other side to address that before your closing argument?
I personally think it clearly was before the board when they heard my cross-examination. They heard all of the different angles by which I attacked Bandera. Perhaps I didn't do it strongly enough then, and perhaps what I said was inappropriate in closings. Well, but if you read the cases, when the judicial officer has relied upon something that hasn't been admitted technically in evidence, this is harmless error.
You'll have to persuade me that it was not an accident, that you didn't put the guide in front of Dr. Banderas during his deposition and say, I draw your attention to Table B, mm-hmm. which is to be used to rate permanency in the event of an injury, Table A in event of an illness. Why do you select B instead of A for your permanency rating?
Well, I mentioned in my briefs that it's not Chrysler's job to make their case. Mm-hmm. And it was a tactical decision on my part.
And that same tactical follow-through was why the issue wasn't raised until your closing argument.
Yes, in part, yeah.
Well, does that mean, if you're suggesting that it's not your burden to make their case, that if Dr. Bandera had been asked questioning along the line that you argued, that he would have had a response? that he would have given an explanation to explain why he was still right and should not be discredited by your argument.
He may have, but...
Well, then the board didn't hear that information, did it?
Correct, but our strategy was to show through Dr. Myers that permanent impairment just does not exist under these circumstances. And the board, after hearing medical expert testimony from our side, and even hearing the claimant and his girlfriend testify, watching 2 years of surveillance, they put the picture together. There's nothing...
Let me ask you the legal question we have to deal with slightly differently. I think we agree that the guide is not going into evidence in its entirety. So we don't have the guide in evidence.
Correct.
And what we have in my question is an expert who testifies about page 20. He's cross-examined on page 20, mm-hmm. So we know to the extent page 20 is in the guide, page 20 is now in the record, and we go back and forth on the relevance. The question we have to decide is if there's a reference to the guide and direct and cross-examination on page 20, is it proper to say, in closing, well, you know, you heard about the guide. Let's look at page 60. If you look at page 60, here's what you find, and everything that we talked about with regard to page 20 is wrong. When page 60 is never discussed, it's not into evidence, it's simply in the guide that was referenced. My question is that permissible or not to go to page 60? In closing.
In my opinion, because of the Turbitt case and the directive that says that the board may independently come to its own conclusion about permanency, that it is not the physician who determines permanent impairment, in this circumstance, yes, to a certain degree, we may stretch that far. What I did was try to present the big picture. If the board is going to look at Dr. Bandera's testimony on a specific table, the board at least has to look at the title of the table or the name of the chapter and why it's used. We can't see things or put things in a vacuum. And a case that I shepherdized when we received notice that we were to talk about the Banks case, it's the Chavin case, even says this, that it's proper to, and I will read it for the court. I have copies for the court as well.
Did you give this reference to counsel before the argument?
Yes, he actually had already done his homework as well. In this case, some evidence regarding a medical issue was introduced regarding a thoracic outlet syndrome. The plaintiff introduced this evidence. The defendants used the same article, a medical article, which was testified to by a medical expert, used it in cross-examination, and then offered the entire article into evidence. The trial judge admitted it over the plaintiff's objection. The court said parts of defendant's exhibit were read by the doctor in answers to the questions on direct. In a sense, a portion of the exhibit was put into evidence by the plaintiffs. That being so, we think the entire article was properly admissible.
Well, and I don't want to take up your time with saying whether that's distinguishable because the entire article was in evidence. But I want to go back to Justice Ridgely's point about due process and related to my question about does it come in during cross or does it come in during closing? And the due process argument is if you're going to talk about page 60, you don't introduce it at closing. Due process requires that the witness have an opportunity to respond to page 60 on the stand under oath during cross-examination.
That may be so. I mean, it sounds like that's where you're going with it.
We're trying to understand and apply a rule of law. And we're not going anywhere except where you help us go. So the question is, you cited a case to us where an entire article has come into evidence. We're deciding a case where an entire treatise has not come into evidence. You're citing the article for the proposition that if you introduce the entire article, you referred to one part, you can refer to the other part. Help us get to an application of that in this case where the entire treatise is not in, you refer to one part, and notwithstanding the fact that the entire treatise isn't in evidence, it's okay to refer to the other part in closing.
The guides are, because of the way the guides are designed, it is a process by which you determine mathematically a loss of function, and you can't look at one section without looking at the whole. In this situation, you have to allow the judicial body to see the big picture. And I think, you know, the notice argument, Dr. Bandera, He's hired to testify about permanency. If he pigeonholes his process without really understanding or explaining the chapter, the board can figure that out themselves. I know the issue is what I said during closings, but there, again, there's nothing in the board's decision that suggests that they even listened to me or heard what I said. There was independent medical testimony in this case.
Well, they discounted the testimony of Dr. Bandera based on your argument in part, didn't they?
I don't know. It's hard to read into what they said. I understand that they said Dr. Bandera misapplied the guides, but was it because they know, as experienced as they are, that he just missed the mark? I suggest that that could be a cause. They didn't say counsel was so persuasive that we're finding Dr. Bandera not credible.
Well, unless you raise that issue before them, before your closing, how does counsel know to address the problem that they might look at the guide independently, a part of the guide different than that Dr. Bandera relied upon?
I think if you practice before the IAB enough, you know that that is a possibility.
Hoisted on my own petard, okay.
Well, I think, you know, that's a separate issue on whether if the board can independently look at the guides, and suppose you had never made your argument, the board just says, well, we've looked at the guides, here's where we are. There's a debate currently going on about jurors and judges doing independent research. We had a different case, different subject matter, where the issue was the availability of employment. A judge did their own market survey on the internet and said, well, I think you can get a job. And this court held that's not what judges do. You decide whether people can get a job based on the market surveys that are introduced into evidence.
And that whole issue that Justice Holland just pointed out generally focuses on notice. You can't do that kind of independent research because the parties don't know that's what you're doing,
right,
and you don't give them a chance to respond. That's the problem.
Is it your position that the board can take judicial notice of the AMA guides?
Well, judicial notice involves, you know, if I have the concept correctly, you know, taking fact or law into consideration that are not subject to reasonable dispute. The guides are sort of a strange animal. It's a book of filled with processes.
Well, is that a yes or a no?
I don't know how that would be helpful.
Well, can they or can they not?
I would say to the extent that they accept the book in general as being applicable to permanency cases, I suppose they could.
Okay, and if they do take judicial notice of anything, doesn't the process involve giving notice during the evidentiary hearing so that the other side can react?
Under your question, yes. Okay. But so, we all knew we were there for a permanency case. And all we talked about was permanency that was discussed during depositions. Perhaps I went too far. I have a feeling I went too far.
Well, is it fair to say that implicit in your argument is everyone there knew that there was an issue about whether these injuries were produced by an illness, produced by an injury, or didn't exist at all in any way related to the workplace?
Did they know?
Everyone knew that was the issue, correct?
Absolutely, from my cross-examination of Dr. Bandera and my whole deposition with Dr. Myers.
And everyone knew that Dr. Bandera relied on the guide when he came to his conclusion, mm-hmm, that it was illness produced, and that's how he formulated his permanency rating.
Well, he was actually sort of in the middle on that.
Well, I understand he equivocated on it, but at the end of the day, he used the table that related to illness.
Injury. He used the table related
I'm
to injury.
I'm sorry, injury. Yes. I did get it mixed up. I apologize. Okay.
The strange thing was there was no cross-examination whatsoever of Dr. Myers, and we were there to discuss permanency issue. 69 pages of cross-examination and not one question asked about permanency. But I addressed it with Dr. Myers. And the board, if you really read the decision carefully in their conclusions, found that there was no permanent impairment. And at each and every body part and each and every issue, they had substantial evidence from Dr. Myers, from a medical expert who wasn't cross-examined, to state that there wasn't any permanent impairment in this case.
Well, the only thing we can guarantee you is that we do read decisions below carefully.
I understand that. I submit to you that my statements, if they were improper, amounted to harmless error. And even when the judges in the cases that you asked us to read went a little bit beyond what was in evidence, for instance, that IAB decision that was referenced, I believe, in the Banks case, the courts held that that was harmless error. There was not any prejudice. Again, we were there to talk about permanency. We had two doctors put their testimony on the table, and we hashed it out in closing arguments. If I was a little overzealous, I apologize.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Referencing the Barks case, or Banks case, I apologize if I'm incorrectly said that. The court there did say that the notice in referencing those outside materials was harmless. They also said it was cumulative evidence, in that those matters had already been covered. In this particular case, I would suggest that, again, prior to the close of the evidentiary record, there was no suggestion that Dr. Bandera had misapplied those guides, and they just didn't exist in the record before the board. So I don't think we're in the same ballpark as cumulative evidence.
Well, it was just suggested to us that there were questions asked about whether this was permanency was the result of an injury or a result of an illness.
Mm-hmm.
Were those questions asked?
When Dr. Bandera was examined?
The injuries that he rated a permanency on,
mm-hmm.
was he asked whether they were a result of illness or injury?
My recollection would be that he was asked whether they were resultant from that condition.
And anyone familiar with the guide would know that there are different ways of rating illness produced and injury produced permanencies.
I mean, anyone familiar with the guides would understand that there are numerous ways that the guides are utilized to rate permanency, and that physicians also can use their own discretion based on their experience in making a rating. I don't think that the guides are 100% controlling as to what a permanency rating is.
Let me make sure I'm not on the wrong track.
Okay.
I thought if one assumed in one's medical opinion to a reasonable certainty that the permanency was produced by an illness, they looked at table A. If, on the other hand, they believe on the same basis that it's produced by an injury, they looked at table B, and you would get different permanency ratings by looking at the different forms of analyses contained in those tables. Is that right or wrong?
That's my understanding as well. I'm not an expert in the AMA guides. But I do think that the point is well taken, that we do have this notice issue, and that the board cannot, I mean, they have their specialized experience, they absolutely do, but they cite Turbitt to say that they're allowed to check into these issues, when I would suggest to your honors that Turbitt specifically cautions them to use their experience to evaluate the evidence before them, and not to become independent investigators. I mean, there are these very dangerous issues floating out there with how one can respond to evidence against them when they don't know what that evidence is. If you have any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Other than that, I'll submit it to you on that basis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll take the case under advisement and recess.